it's 25 years I can't get back, and I'm not going to regret it because it made me more self-aware, more respectful of myself, and more loving, and as you said, forgiving of myself, because I have to give myself the same grace that I would give anyone else who has been through something that they certainly didn't ask for or choose. But I think that once you can just understand what it is, you can move forward.
Welcome to Give a Heck. I am your host, Dwight Heck, and for much of my life, lived my life in quiet desperation, wondering how I was going to pay the bills, take vacations, save for retirement, and one day wondering if I would get off the hamster wheel of life and have purpose. A life that most of society lives, which takes us to work, then home, then repeat, and pays us hopefully enough just to survive. The harsh truth that most live with more month than money and have no idea how to live life on purpose, not by accident. This ensures the mass majority are living not just financially broke, however emotionally and mentally as well due to financial pressures. In each episode, I will introduce you to thoughts, ideas, and guests that can help you to learn how you too can live life on purpose, not by accident. Good day and welcome to Give a Heck. On today's show, I welcome Dana Diaz. Dana is a wife, mother, and author of the best-selling book, Gasping for Air, The Stranglehold of a Narcissistic Abuse. Dana has had lifelong experience with narcissistic abuse beginning in childhood. Her education in journalism and psychology at DePaul University in Chicago gave her the ability to accurately verbalize and express how narcissistic abuse creates confusion and conflict within victims so that she can help other victims know they are not alone and better understand their own circumstances. Today, Dana is a proud voice for fellow victims who are unable, afraid, or ashamed to share their experiences. She strives to create awareness and understanding to ensure victims are given the support they need to first understand their situation and then begin the healing process. Her first book, chronicling her own abusive marriage that lasted nearly three decades, started as a journal that she hid under the couch cushion in the basement. Dana lives with her husband in Illinois and is in the process of publishing the prequel and sequel to Gasping for Air. I'd like to welcome you to the show, Dana. Thanks so much for agreeing to come on and share with us some of your life journey.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here and share whatever it is you think will benefit people who are listening to this, because as we already discussed, there's a lot to unravel with this subject.
Oh, absolutely. There certainly is. So one of the things, as I mentioned to you before I hit record, that I focus on is a person's origin story, their earliest recollections to where they are today. It helps people be able to connect with you before they hear all the different details of what you've experienced after the fact. So Dana, please tell me your origin story and what key things from your childhood to adulthood that led you to where you're at currently.
My origin story is very clear to me. It's actually the prequel that I've just written to Gasping for Air, which I'm hoping will be out this summer. It's kind of it's so dramatic, but I'm so glad that I've been able to overcome it. But I was born to a teenage mother back in the 70s, obviously unplanned, and she didn't want me. And I'm going to say that pretty confidently, because after my birth, right after I was born, she had her tubes tied so that she couldn't have any more children. And they did do that in the 70s, even if you were a teenager, I suppose. But it was just, there was always this emotional and physical distance from her, because like I said, I don't think she wanted children at all. And I was not a happy accident. And in fact, I even remember as a young child being referred to as an accident, being referred to as a mistake, being referred to as what he did to her, meaning my biological father, although I would argue it takes two to tango unless it's, you know, a sexual offense, which I don't believe it was, because they were boyfriend and girlfriend. So it was really hard, you know, feeling that from her, but I was very fortunate that my great grandma, I stayed with her because my mother, being a teenager, despite being a young mother, she was working and trying to get her GED and get her life back on track after I was born. Great grandma was at home, so she was happy to have me. So I did have her when I was crying at night and needed soothing. She made sure I was bathed and clothed and loved me and rocked me and did all the things a mother would. And I have very fond memories of her. I love her dearly. Unfortunately, where things took a really sharp left turn was when my mother met the man that she eventually married when I was 7 years old. I remember the first time very clearly that I met him. And again, people have to remember, I was very, very young, what, four, maybe 4 years old, five. But I remember I just didn't like him. He seemed to me nice. He was wearing a smile. I couldn't put my finger on it. I was a kid. What did I know? I just didn't like him. I mean, really didn't like him. So time went on and I knew why I didn't like him. He was one way around my mother, around my mother's family, around his family. And then at home, if it was just him and I alone, it was very different. And unfortunately, I was home alone with him a lot because my mother, she, just like she had left me with my great grandma, you know, she kind of just went and lived her life. She went to work. She, you know, did whatever she was doing. And he was charged with getting me ready to for school, driving me to school. You know, at the end of the day, you know, sometimes he'd have to make sure I'd have dinner and whatever else. But he didn't want to be my father. And I know this because he told me. It's kind of strange to be a child and be, you know, I'm all for being truthful with your children, but when you have a young developing girl who you are telling every single day, nobody loves you, not even your mother, I shouldn't have to pay for another man's child, you're a burden, you're not smart enough. I even remember multiple times from the time I was 5, 6 years old, that bread you're eating is going to make you fat. That bowl of spaghetti is going to give you hips like a middle-aged woman. I was a little girl. I was eating peanut butter jelly sandwiches. Like, isn't that what kids eat? So it was verbally abusive, and I was tenacious, and I was something. I would stand up to him, and I would say, no, you can't talk to me like that. That's not true. My mother does too love me. Unfortunately, I wasn't sure that she did, but I would go to her because she was my mother, expecting her to do something about this man's treatment of me. Because along with this verbal abuse, when I spoke up and stood up for myself, there would be physical consequence. And it started off, you know, just with little stuff, like when I always wore two pigtails when I was little, and when he'd do my pigtails, he'd pull them tight. I mean, so tight that my eyes would stretch back. Even the kids at school would make comments that I looked Asian because my eyes were pulled, stretched back. And I don't mean any offense to anybody, but in the 70s and 80s, kids were awful. They said everything, and so did their parents. But I mean, but it hurt. It gave me headaches. And if I squealed because he was pulling the pigtails too tight, he'd hit me with the brush. If I reached for the phone to call my mother at work, he beat me with the phone once. You know, just things were happening that should not happen. I'm all for disciplining, and how people discipline their children is their option. But my big issue in life is when you intentionally harm somebody. You know, at school, we call this bullying. In life, in adult life, we call it abuse. If you're a kid on the other end of these things and can't get out, it is abuse. But unfortunately, my mother wouldn't listen. She would tell me that either I was misinterpreting his behavior, that maybe if I didn't provoke him to be angry, or, well, if he didn't care about you so much, he wouldn't get so angry, because he does love you, because he wouldn't be that angry if he didn't love you, you know. And it's kind of putting this idea, planting this idea in my head that, okay, love equates to pain, I guess. Is that like how this works in, you know, a couple situation or a parent-child relationship? But, you know, it was strange to me because, like I said, my great grandma didn't treat me that way. My uncles, who were very doting and very loving towards me, they were my first so-called father figures in life. They were very good to me. They were very sweet to me and defended and protected, you know, like a father should. But this man, my stepfather, just didn't want any part of me. And he wanted to make me feel like the nothing he thought I was because I was deficient. I was told my mother, you know, thought she was going to have a boy. Well, I was a girl. That was my first mistake. And then, you know, I wasn't my stepfather's biological child. So I was deficient in that way. I had the wrong DNA. They even went through a process when I was 7 years old. They started the process of reversing my mother's tubal ligation so they could have, he, my stepfather wanted a child of his own because, you know, and what message does that say when you are using these words to a kid? It was that I'm being replaced because I'm deficient. So if I'm not good enough, how, you know, to the two people that are supposed to be, and I'm using the term loosely, raising me, then how am I supposed to feel good enough? How am I supposed to have any sense of esteem? I didn't. I internalized all of it. I didn't think it was right. I argued with it. I stood up against it, but I still internalized it. So yes, by the time I was 18 and left that house, I mean, I didn't know what it was back then, but I was a codependent, people-pleasing, love-starved girl, just desperate for anybody to give me any crumb of attention or affection. I just wanted somebody to find some worth in me because I didn't even think I was worthy.
Wow, you have gone on quite the journey. You know,
Yeah.
when I think about some of the notes I wrote down, like your great grandma raised me. Where was your grandma in all of this?
My grandma was actually working. Well, here's the other aspect of it. So when I was born, I was later told, much later, that great grandma, the deal was great grandma would keep me, you know, take care of me, and grandma would work, get a job to pay for my expenses. So they were basically relieving my mother of her motherly duties, which was actually just fine with me. I wish she would have left me there and left me that way. But grandma was also in a marriage toward that was about the end of her marriage when I was a young girl. But I don't even call him my grandfather. It's sad because I only met him a couple times in my life before he passed, but I was kept from him because he was an abusive narcissist. You know, even taking the narcissist out of it, we're talking about a man who had a very severe alcohol problem to the point that he did need a liver transplant. And the day he was released from the hospital after the transplant, he went straight to the bar and kept drinking. He even left me in a bar, I was told, when I was 3 years old. He wanted to supposedly take me for the afternoon and spend time with me, promising to stay sober. But left me in a bar in the city of Chicago because he wanted to leave with a woman that wasn't my grandma, who he was still married to at the time. And yeah, so fortunately,
Wow.
somebody that knew him and knew where he lived took me back to, you know, my grandma, and I was safe. So that was a good thing. But yeah, he was not. He was something. My grandma had a lot to deal with over there. And I think it's sad to say that now, I mean, I'm 48 years old and my grandma's 84, but you know, now we are very close, me and my grandma, because I've been able to share and be open with her about my experiences. And I'm now able to hear, you know, all the things she went through. You know, she tells me of, you know, he hit her once and she used mace in his eyes, and oh my gosh, he beat her after that. And another time she woke up in the middle of the night and came down to their living room and found him having sex with another woman, and he put a gun to my mother's head when she was a young girl in the middle of the night, put her in the bathtub with her two brothers and held the gun to their head. So, you know, my grandma was going through stuff, and it's not that she
Well,
didn't love me, but
she was doing
she
what
was going
best
through
she
stuff.
could. Yeah, she
Yeah.
was doing the best she could. It's the reason I asked is because there's always patterns, right? There's that follow generational challenges, right? And character building moments. And unfortunately, it started all the way back in your life, and it continues to pass down to the next generations. And when young people, you know, they just want to be kids, even yourself, you learn things from so many interactions with broken adults, and we don't realize how it's affecting us until we get older. And then our reactions and our patterns are driven by that. We're not even sure why. And until somebody decides to break the chain like you have, right? Yeah. And are continuing to work on, because we're a work in project the rest of our lives when we've gone through trauma like that. It's not something that happens once in a while. It's with us every single day. It's part of our who we are. But the difference is it doesn't have to define us. It doesn't have to define us any longer. We just need to put in the work and the effort to, you know, release that hostility, that anger, and forgive ourselves. Because forgiving, everybody always says we got to forgive. You got to forgive that person. Well, it starts with forgiving ourselves because of the trauma we've gone through. We don't necessarily, in my opinion, like my own narcissistic garbage that I went through, forgiving that person released me, not released them. Because they don't think, they're not sitting there. I tell people all the time when I'm coaching them, they're not sitting there thinking of you, right?
No,
as you're
not.
Thinking, they're not. They're stuck in their rut. They're stuck in their hamster wheel and their patterns, and they're going to continue to live that way. They're going to teach others to live that way. Their associations in their life are going to be the exact same thing. If they're a drinker, like your grandfather, he's hanging out with drinkers. If they're negative person, they're hanging out with negativity. So congratulations to you for working on you and continuing to work on you. I know, because I'm a work in project the rest of my life till I take my last breath, right? And I'm proud of that because at least that means I'm always on the climb, right? I'm always trying to better myself and have
that's
character building
thing.
Days, right? But that's
I have so many people that come to me and say, but no, that, you know, it's nice that this happened for you, that you could heal, that you could love again. It won't happen to me, though. I'm broken and I'm damaged. And that drives me. That gnaws at me when people, I used to call myself broken and damaged. And there's all these memes on Pinterest and, you know, other social media about being broken. You're not broken or damaged. I always tell people, you're affected because you're human and you have a heart. But it doesn't, like you said, define who you are. Just like they say with, you know, physical disabilities, mental, you know, somebody isn't a schizophrenic. They have schizophrenia. They are still a human being. They have some issue that they're trying to deal with. But people have to start looking at their circumstances or adversities, disabilities, as just challenges that you can rise above, you can overcome. I know women that have been told that they'll never have children and they have three beautiful children. I know people that, you know, one girl that she'll never drive, she'll never develop normally. She drives a beautiful vehicle and has a great job, you know, and if her parents had listened to doctors, you know, she'd be deemed deaf and dumb and nobody. And so we have to stop letting people define us. And, you know, my childhood is a perfect example of that, because I mean, I'm 48 years old and there are still some days where that replay, that loop that replays in my head of my stepfather saying, oh, you know, you'll never be, you know, that's not good enough. And nobody's going to, you know, it gets me, but it's just a little stumble backwards. And then I'm like, nope, I'm going to keep putting one foot in front of the other. If anything, I now look at it as, you know what, tell me what I can't do. Tell me what I'm not, because I'm going to be that and I'm going to be more, just to show you, because I can and everybody can.
Well, tenacity becomes our superpower, right?
Yes.
It becomes our weapon against the programming that we've experienced our whole lives. And for some people, it's not their whole lives. That programming starts when they get into that relationship, where it doesn't even have to be a significant other. It can be friends. It can be family.
Yes.
It can
Co-worker,
be so many different.
Anything.
It can exactly co-workers, and that programming can start later on, and it continually runs. But eventually you can overwrite that programming, and those moments where the program decides to run again, you learn to put specific things in your life to actually squash it. You learn when it's time to understand your body language. It's to yes. understand how you're feeling and what did you do that day or the day before that's making you feel that way? Maybe it's something you watched. Maybe it's somebody you talked to. Maybe it's something you read. And I know myself, I've learned to reflect. Okay, I'm in bed now. I'm sitting here having gratefulness, but I got this gnawing feeling. What yes. happened today, or was it yesterday? What did somebody say to me or read? So I start analyzing it, not to make it worse, but to make me so that it doesn't happen again. So right. I try to, as hard as I can, avoid that. Not that it's 100% possible, but to work on ourselves means you need to work on yourself. You need to put that
You need effort. To be aware of what you're doing and be aware of what you want to improve, and then make the choice to improve it. Whether it's leaving a toxic relationship like I left my last marriage, or whether it's making the choice that, okay, I don't like how I reacted to this. You know, I'm going to react a different way. You have to make the choice. And so I look at, like I said, these adverse situations we find ourselves in, they are temporary. They may be long-term, but they're temporary, hopefully. Once we make the choice that we want different, we will have different. But, you know, it's interesting. This goes along with something you mentioned earlier too, but with this as well, is that people don't realize psychologically, children by the age of around 7 years old are hardwired, for lack of better words, as to how they perceive gender roles, family roles, societal roles, things like that. And especially, you know, imagine, like, when I was a kid, you just had your surrounding family. You had school to observe behaviors and situations, maybe church. Now people are hit with, you know, all this social media, and every kid has some electronic device they're staring at for hours every day. You know, all the different things people see, we are all internalizing other people's experiences as well as our own, you know, so it's really hard to break those chains and break those cycles. And certainly, you know, there are generational traumas that continue because that's all you know, that's what you're familiar with. But once you make that choice and say, no, that is not what I want, it takes a great amount of effort. And this is basically what the healing process looks like, is this situation triggered me. I don't like how it made me feel, whether it's just unsettling or a full-blown panic attack, as I've had many. And you have to just learn to recognize it. Number one, stop yourself. And my magic phrase is, what do I want right now? What do I want right now? Do I need to go take a deep breath? Do I need to get some fresh air? Do I need this person to hug me and tell me they love me and that none of this matters and we'll resolve it later? Whatever it is, maybe I need to just go sit by myself in a quiet room and just think for a minute. What do I want right now? That is called self-regulating. When you can self-regulate, stop yourself, and just kind of focus and kind of reset, that's a better word for it, then you can make a better go at it the next time around. And eventually you'll practice this enough that you'll get good at it, so that instead of saying, I'm going to avoid these people in these situations, although there are certain ones you probably will anyway, I certainly have mine, I can still go and say, okay, you know what? I'm going to dip my toes in the water. I'm going to go to this knowing this person is there that triggers me, but I'm only going to stay 30 minutes out of the 2-hour event. Make my appearance, say my hellos, be courteous and polite. But if I feel uncomfortable, I have an exit. I am driving separately. I am not engaging with this person or that. I will not react to anything that comes at me. I'm going to walk away. You just have to kind of have an action plan, but you have to be aware. Now, unfortunately, narcissists have no self-awareness because their ego can't handle the idea that they might not be perfect. So your words are lost on them. Your energy is lost on them. Your time is lost on them. They feel no remorse. They feel no empathy. They don't care. So, you know, I hate the phrase, let them go, but you got to just let them go and work on you. And that's why when people say, what are the red flags? It's like, yeah, there's narcissistic qualities. We can make a list, but really we have to look inward and say, how is my energy around this person? How is, does this person make me feel? So it's not about them anymore. It's about you. Because if you know who you are and you feel comfortable with who you are and you can control, better control how you react because you're more self-aware, then you're in a better position to handle, you know, the people in life that come at you and decide whether you want to give them more time or energy. Because I know I gave my ex 25 years too long as far as I'm concerned, but you know, it's 25 years I can't get back, and I'm not going to regret it because it made me more self-aware, more respectful of myself, and more loving, and as you said, forgiving of myself, because I have to give myself the same grace that I would give anyone else who has been through something that they certainly didn't ask for or choose. But I think that once you can just understand what it is, you can move forward.
Well, yeah. And the biggest thing is, though, is, you know, forgiving ourselves and talking to ourselves a certain way. I have to remind myself, if somebody was going through the similar traumas and we were having a conversation, how would I talk to them? Well, if I talked to them with kindness and empathy and understanding, then I need to look at myself in the mirror and talk that same way. And even if I'm not in front of a mirror, just sitting quietly, having a cup of coffee, or just sitting in peace, and our mind is worrying all the time, and literally, why are you thinking like that? I'll talk to myself, why are you thinking like that? That serves no purpose, right? Your old you would let that pull you down, and you'd have days, weeks of feeling like garbage. Yes. And I get to a point now where through programming and through planning and what I coach others, I never have a bad day. I only have I only have character building moments. We all have character building moments.
I love how you look at that. That's beautiful, though.
And we can lie to ourselves, but we all have character building moments, right? So I tell myself, no matter what happens today, I'm never telling myself I had a bad day, because now I've discounted everything, even the gratefulness of opening my eyes and going, thank you for another day, right? The moment I wake up, gratefulness and gratitude are something that need to be taught within our school systems. One of the things, though, I'd really like you to do, though, is for those listening, we probably should have done this a little bit sooner, explain the definition of what narcissism is, because so many people have a misnomer of what it is and they don't understand what it is. And share some examples that would, you know, some more simple examples, obviously, for those listening or watching on YouTube, as to what narcissism is. And here's an example of it. Like, yes, you talked about some of yours, but it's not detailed for them to maybe be able to better relate.
No, absolutely. I'm going to start with where narcissism, where we got the word. We got the word from the Greek god Narcissus. He was the god that liked to admire his reflection in the water because apparently he looked so good, he just couldn't stop looking at himself. And these are the people that we see on social media taking their selfies in their bikinis or with their, you know, six-pack abs and all this stuff. We cannot hate them because they usually look as good as they think they do. So, you know, God love the healthy self-esteem. I wish I had it. But that is really what narcissism means, is, you know, kind of, you know, having that healthy self-esteem, that like for how you look. What it has come to mean, however, and this is where we get confused and where it starts getting used very loosely in our society, it has come to mean somebody who needs to feel superior to others, needs to feel important. And on the lower end of the spectrum, this is just annoying. You know, I liken it to a tumor, like a benign tumor will be in your body. It's not bothering you necessarily. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it's just there. Whereas on the other end of the narcissistic spectrum, we have what we call malignant narcissists, like malignant tumors that are going to cause you problems intentionally. They might even kill you. And, you know, you have to cut them out of your life. And these are people like my husband loves watching 48 Hours or some of these true crime shows. But boy, 9 times out of 10, we're talking straight narcissism. These are people who feel that they are justified in committing these crimes, that they feel they are above law. They feel entitled. Some can be arrogant about it. Some can be more humble and what we call covert, you know, unsuspecting. But all in all, they all need to feel a sense of superiority. It's just that some actually do think they're superior and some actually don't think that they're important at all. So they need to get that admiration and that praise and that exaltation from others. But abuse and acting various forms of abuse gives them that sense of control and gives them that power that they're looking for.
Yeah. That's a great explanation. I know quite a few narcissists in my life. Unfortunately, I lived through it myself. How does narcissism and gaslighting tie together?
Well, gaslighting is a form of manipulation. It's basically a form of low-end brainwashing, for lack of better words. So a gaslighting would be, and Lord, I have always said, I could tell my mother that the sky is blue, and she would say, I don't know what you're looking at. It looks more lavender to me, or it's periwinkle, or, you know, like it's just negating yeah. what you're saying. Or
exactly.
Or like with my ex, it might be like, oh, well, when this really hurt my feelings when you said this, oh, well, I was joking. I didn't mean it. You know, things like that, where it's like, no, you were serious. Actually, I remember very well. Nobody was laughing. Well, you're just too sensitive. You just took it the wrong way.
So it's a deflection back.
Yeah, it turns things around to where you're being blamed, your perspective's being negated, your sense of reality sometimes over time can just completely get skewed. And that's certainly what happened to me, because my mother was the supreme gaslighter. You know, there were times when she'd even witness things that her husband was, you know, verbally abusing me with, or physical abuse. And she would just wash her dishes or look around like she had no idea what was going on, you know, and I'd be screaming. And I mean, talk about, you know, it's sort of like ghosting, like they do these days, just pretending you're not there. But that is a form of gaslighting. And over a long period of time, you do tend to doubt your reality. It causes you to be confused. You don't even know what's what anymore. And that's actually what compelled me to start my journal. It wasn't any pretty leather-bound journal. It was just an old notebook I got from my son's pile of old school notebooks that he had scribbled little, you know, people all over and on half the pages. But I needed to write down when something was said to me or when something happened, I would write down the date and a brief description so that I knew what was what. If it was a text message, I wrote it down word for word, just so that when it might come up and I was told that that didn't happen and that was never said and that I'm the one that's crazy, I could go to my notebook or go back to my phone and say, no, I'm looking at it right here. It did indeed happen, because I was so, you know, when I had my mother telling me things and my husband, I was getting two sides of gaslighting. So yeah, I started to wonder, I want to make sure I'm okay. I started to think like, is it me? Because I'm the common denominator. Both of these people are telling me that nothing I see is what it is. Nothing I hear is what I think I hear. Nothing I think is correct. So that is gaslighting.
Well, our brain is a giant computer and it doesn't know the difference between the truth and the lies. So when you're inundated by a group of people constantly telling you that you didn't see what you seen, you didn't experience what you experienced, you know, like you were saying in regards to the color of the sky or whatever the case may be,
yeah.
It eventually you just want to give up. You don't have anything to hang on to. And until you get to a specific age, even age doesn't always fix it, because as an adult, look what you went through. Look what I went through. Our associations or who we hang out with are people that should be supportive and they're not. They're adding right. more gasoline to the gaslighting and adding more gasoline to the fact of our worthiness of what we believe, or they'll listen to us and initially they'll give us advice or they'll be supportive. But because our patterns don't change, they eventually walk away, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's not, though. I used to be mad. Why did that person leave my life? Well, when I look back at it, I understand why now.
Yeah.
They could only handle so much. They were worried about them and their own 6 inches between their ears and right. their own life more than they, and I, they couldn't handle the fact that I was that same loop every time we talked. I was going through maybe a little bit different circumstances, but it was the same loop of trauma. And that's why it's so important today for people to get help. Unfortunately, cost is the barrier to getting help. Wouldn't you agree? How can people afford to get help?
It is. And also for anybody that was in a situation like mine, in my marriage, I was highly monitored. So I had to be careful. I mean, even if I went to the store for food, you know, cat food, I was timed. I felt like I was on a retractable dog leash. I would start getting messages or phone calls. Where are you? It can't possibly take that long. How much did you, you know, so I couldn't just freely go anywhere. I couldn't even go out with friends. I mean, by the end of our 25-year relationship, I didn't even have friends anymore because I hadn't seen any. He wouldn't let me talk to them on the phone in the house. It was bothersome to his television watching. I couldn't go anywhere without him guilting me for going there, accusing me of meeting somebody that I was going to have sex with. Or, I mean, even if when I went to church on Sunday, which I invited him to come along with me, you know, to mass, he would put up an argument and accuse me that I'm going to have sex with my 80 some year old priest. It was just so exhausting that I just didn't go anywhere. So no, I couldn't be like, I'm going to therapy because to be married to you, I need some counseling. That wasn't going to fly. And a lot of these narcissists especially are very stringent on money. They didn't like my stepfather and my husband. Boy, if I said I was going to the doctor and God forbid I needed a lab test that I had some financial commitment, you know, to uphold, that just led to argument. So no, counseling is not always the readily available option for a lot of people that are in abusive or domestic violence situations.
Even outside of those abusive relationships, like I look at one of my own children and she's no longer with the narcissist, but his cheapness, his frugalness, whatever you want to call it, affects her today. When he's supposed to pay for certain things, he doesn't. When, you know, they need mm-hmm. new clothes, it doesn't happen. It, you know right. what I mean? He's completely non-committal financially. And it was there when they were together. It's there when they're apart. And I went through it too. I know with my ex, I eventually got to a point in order to have peace between my 6 inches. So those listening or watching, sometimes the same thing I've told my one daughter is sometimes you just have to look at that pain pleasure principle. And the pain of begging for money or support from my ex wasn't worth it. I took on 100% of the responsibility just so I wouldn't have to hear it anymore. Or I wouldn't have to have it deflected on me or gaslit that I was the child. Why are we doing this? Oh, you're, mm-hmm. you know, why are you picking stuff that's this cost? Or I don't have it, but yet they were had new clothing or they were going you know, they're buying whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And at the end of the day, it doesn't end just because you separate from that person if you have children.
Yes. Right?
Until, thank
Even
goodness.
Even if you don't have kids, yeah.
You know, it's there forever because especially if you are in the same vicinity of one another or have mutual things where you'd run into one another, it's PTSD all day long.
I even hear
about my ex from my kids. Only one of them of the five still talks to her. So that one child will bring her up in conversation. Or I'll have to text that person because she's visiting that child and I need access to the kids and she's watching or babysitting them, my grandkids. I can feel my chest tight. I feel gross, and I want to go home and have a shower.
Yeah,
it really, and I haven't even had to see her.
You.
Just the text makes me feel,
yes.
Ugh.
Well,
And just talking about it.
But that's the thing, that's trauma bond stuff, because people don't realize we talk about this trauma bond, but what it really is, a lot of it is that chemical reaction in our bodies. Something about that, you know, it could be just be that text message, or like my ex liked to hide his alcohol in cans of Sprite. So if I see an open can of Sprite, I'm immediately like, I get that kind of like cat's ears up and you know, high alert, like, uh-oh. And then I'm like, oh, wait, he's not here. But, you know, it's because that cortisol, that stress hormone runs through your body, because it remembers running through your body when that person texted you or when you saw the Sprite can or whatever it is. But yeah, that's something I had to tell my son, and which people need to understand. I never could get, like, you know, it takes a lot. To get to the point where you file for divorce, and then there's time between filing for the divorce and actually getting the divorce. But as I told my son when he was upset, when I had to tell him we were divorced, you know, his dad and I were divorced, I said, honey, it's a piece of paper that divided our financial assets. Believe me, I wish it ended the relationship.
It doesn't.
The relationship is nowhere near over.
The accusations are there. The accusations are in the relationship.
Yes.
The accusations are during the divorce, even get worse. They're there after the fact, and they can even be more nasty, because they want to, now they don't have you in proximity to control you and gaslight you. So they try doing
it. So it gets worse.
Through emails,
they pack it in.
Texts, 15 phone calls in a row where I don't answer, and voicemails, and oh my gosh, just the things that it doesn't end until you get to a point. For me, the trauma is still there. I deal with it. I know how to, work through it, have just those character building moments, get past it. The nice thing though is eventually, those listening, you can get to a point where your kids are at an age where you can say, like I did to my kids, listen, your relationship is your relationship. You do what you want with them. But I am, if you know, the only time I will ever see that person is if you invite them to your wedding. And if, you know, if they pass, I won't be there. If they have something traumatizing go on and they're in the hospital, I'm not coming to visit them. I'm not coming with you. I can't be that support person for you because I need to protect me. Right.
100%.
And when you get to a certain age, that's what you have to do with kids.
Well,
Sorry.
You have to do it. Absolutely. And I would even argue that once they're teenagers, I would say over 14 or 15, depending on their maturity level at that point. I was lucky that my son was 17 at the time of the divorce, because of course my then still husband was pitting, you know, my son against me, telling him things that were blatantly untrue. And my son would come to me and say, well, dad said this, did you really do that? Well, why did you? And I wouldn't confirm, I wouldn't deny. I would tell him exactly what you just said. You know what? That's your dad, your relationship. I can't control what he says to you. My concern is you. All you need to know is I love you. I'm the one that's here. And I think I got really lucky, actually, that in the divorce, my ex didn't want any part of our kid. He didn't want any custody, not joint, not shared, no visitation. He didn't want to provide any financial responsibility, not one penny. So I was kind of glad, like, you know what? I'm going to take my kid and I'm going to go. I don't have to deal with you. Even though he's a minor, I don't have to deal with you. Hallelujah. Amen. Moving on, because I just couldn't. But, you know, it's funny with these narcissists, they will stand their ground and they will walk away and tell everybody what a horrible person you are, and that, you know, you're glad they're better off without you. But boy, they know how to manipulate you, and they don't like to have to start over with somebody else. So they will keep coming back and trying a lot of the time. Who's lucky enough to have one that doesn't, God love you.
I tried going back with my ex because I felt like I was a failure. That house and the white picket fence and 2.1 kids, right? The 0.1 being a dog, right? I would literally, I put myself through that trauma again and got treated the same
Right.
way, then tossed aside. You know what I mean? It was just,
Oh, I do.
our
They
programming
say
is so powerful. You know,
it
a
is.
person really needs to find that person that can be the anchor that can help them past all this
Yes.
trauma. And for those that can't afford counseling, thank goodness there is so many great books out there that can help you. There's yes, YouTube is massive. It's the largest search engine, you know,
There's a lot
on the
out there
planet.
that's
There's
helpful.
lots of good stuff that you can watch
Yeah.
and start that process, those little baby steps. Reach out to people like Dana or myself and have a conversation. Maybe we can give you some direction and focus. But
Absolutely.
one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, I mentioned about my five children. All of them have been in terrible relationships. Just about every one of them have been in relationships with a narcissist, probably because they lived that life with, when they were younger. They attract it. It's comfortable for them. The
Yeah.
uncomfortableness is what stops us from growing if we don't have the right support, right? So are all narcissists abusive? And if so,
No.
what are the most common forms of abuse that one faces, whether it's
Oh.
abusive or non-abusive? What can a person expect?
Absolutely. Yeah. Not all narcissists are abusive. Like I said, if you think about tumors, benign tumors aren't going to kill you, malignant ones will. It's the same
Yeah.
thing. There is actually a spectrum where it starts at it's just annoying because they really talk about how much they love the way they look to okay, straight up domestic violence and they murder people. So narcissists tend to, you just have to look for people that are controlling, but abusive about the control. And when we say narcissistic abuse, just so I can clarify, all that means is when a narcissist abuses you. So it's not a specific type of abuse necessarily. It is the worst form of abuse though, because they will use any and all forms of abuse. In my childhood, my narcissistic stepfather only physically and verbally abused me. In my marriage, Lord, I was physically abused, verbally abused, sexually abused, legally abused. Did I put financial in there? Financial abuse is a big one. Any kind, even just the silent treatment. A lot of them like the silent treatment. My stepfather and my ex-husband used this on me. This is war stuff. This is stuff our military did with hostage criminal, criminals of war in Guantanamo Bay. We don't ignore for weeks a person we're married to or our child. That's not okay. So I always go to anything that is intentionally harming a human being. Intentional harm is abuse. And this is whether it is just bullying, whether it's just being mean, or all the way to domestic violence. And please know that even though there was a lot of physical threat in my marriage and a lot of things that happened, but the two worst incidents of domestic violence happened after the divorce, after he was out of the house and after he didn't have the daily control. Because as you said, when they're not there to throw in the snide remarks and insult you and guilt you and, do all the things they have access to you to do, it will get worse. Because they know that they've lost the war and they're desperate to make you pay for it.
Now they're trying to feed their own monster, and they're
Yeah.
looking for fuel, and that fuel's now escaped them. And unfortunately, many narcissists that I've experienced will find somebody else as soon as they
Oh,
can,
yeah.
if they can't get past you. Could be 6 months, 9 months, a year, who knows how long it is until you finally stop feeding them and
Yeah.
literally shut them down as best you can. Obviously, it's impossible when you have to have communication because, like for me, for with kids. But at the end of the day, I know we've talked a little bit about it, but if you're a person that's in any form of relationship, significant other, friend, coworker, whatever, what are some of the specific signs that one should look for to know if they're in a relationship with a narcissist?
The two big ones that I look for are, first of all, the verbal stuff. Maybe because I've been so highly affected, it has affected me more than the physical. If somebody is insulting you, calling you names, gaslighting you, just using words to make you feel doubtful or crazy, or it can't even be little stuff. Like, I remember my ex telling me once, somebody gave me a red lipstick to wear for Christmas. I thought it was festive, and he told me I looked like a whore. And it, ouch, or are you going to wear those shoes out? We're going to a nice restaurant. You're going to wear those shoes, stuff like that, but straight out to cussing and call it, like my ex used to call me an FC. I won't say those words on your podcast, but people can put them together. It's a very vulgar thing to call your wife that you've been with for 25 years, but to call me that with such regularity that it didn't even faze me, that I responded to it like my own name. That's not okay. That's not okay. Somebody who likes you, loves you, or has any slight respect for you would not speak to you that way. They would not insult you. They would not demean you. They would never call you those sorts of names. I mean, it might slip out once or twice. We're human, but not with any regularity or consistency, and not without an apology. The other thing I look for is the control. This is just, I think, a basic thing that I don't care what relationship, but if somebody is trying to control you in any way, control who your friends are, control where you go, control what you wear, control what you say. I mean, my ex-husband used to ask me a question and he would immediately follow it with, "You're supposed to respond by saying da 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 da." It's like, well, then why are you even asking me? Like, I'm not a Stepford wife. I'm not a robot. If you want that, get yourself an Amazon Echo or something. Talk to Alexa. Like, I just didn't understand that. But unfortunately, I can joke about it now, but it's not funny when it's every damn day. That's not okay. So,
we those smile are the or we chuckle for. Because of the uncomfortableness. It's not even the fact that we think it's funny. It's uncomfortable.
Well, I can laugh about some things now, yeah. Because some of the stuff is toddler-like. You feel like you're married to a child sometimes.
Oh my gosh, yes. And, so when you're saying some of this stuff and you're laughing or I smile about it, a lot of times it's still uncomfortable. It's an uncomfortableness.
It's nerves,
Yes, it's nerves, and it is what it is. We just have to keep on pushing forward. Right. Again, as I mentioned, I struggled myself with it, and to cope and heal is a lifelong journey through that process. Yes. Because it's always in your face, especially yes. with you doing what you've done and written a yes. book and speak on podcasts. It's yes. healing, but it's always in your face. So what would you recommend is the way to start that healing process once a person does realize, like we talked about, therapy, we talked about YouTube, we talked about this different things, but how does a person come to terms with it and start that healing process in your experience?
Well, I think the first thing, there's two things to this for me, because, going back to the financial ability, I mean, I found myself at 45 years old. I was a single mother stuck with the house that I had the mortgage on. I had a kid that was a senior in high school getting ready to go off to school in Wyoming where he'd already been accepted. And I've got full financial, responsibility for all this. So no, I couldn't squeeze therapy. I couldn't afford that. So I started and it worked for me. And I always recommend to just start with yourself, because I think when we come out of these situations where our life has been dictated to us, where I call it the rules, there were so many rules I had to go by that I wasn't even free to have a thought or an opinion or a preference of my own. I started to give myself that grace of saying, what do I want for dinner? I don't have to cook what he wants anymore. I could have what I want. Or what do I want to do? Do I want to go out with a friend? I'm going to go out with a friend for a glass of wine after work. Or, I'm going to wear that, that dress because I like it. I'm going to paint my nails. It's sort of like putting deposits in your little happy jar. The things that make you, you, indulge them. Just indulge them, because I think once you start doing that, you'll rediscover who you are and you'll be able to stand more firmly on your own two feet, knowing who you are again. And there's some wonderful thing that happens when you're living your life authentically. And that's that this thing called self-esteem and self-respect and self-love starts to develop when you are taking care with yourself, taking care of you for once. So I just tell people, start there. You know, when I say self-care, people think massages and bubble baths, and that's lovely. And honestly, if that makes you feel good, go do it. I liked to walk, so I did a lot of walking. I love music, so I would play music as loud as I wanted to and sing and dance in the kitchen while I was making my dinner. But whatever would put a smile on my face, I just wanted to feel joy again to the things that made me happy, me and just me. And I will say this, I know that I felt selfish at first. It's not selfish. I think you have to know who you are and you have to love who you are so that you know what you are offering out in the world. Because if an opportunity to love comes along again, I know none of us are necessarily like out there looking for it after a situation like that. It's like, oh my gosh, like I didn't even trust myself to be able to make that kind of a decision. But I don't want people to think they have to close themselves off either. We are all human. We were not fools. We were just very open-hearted and gracious people giving some other human being a chance, to be who we thought they were, I guess, is the best way to put it. But it's certainly no reflection on us. And we just have to kind of, you know, dust ourselves off, live in the firm truth of who you are authentically, and just understand that was something wrong with them. They have issues that they were putting on you. And that's how that manifested outwardly, was in abuse towards you. It was their unhealed trauma that they can't face, that they were burdening you with. Now you're traumatized. I get it. I am, you are, we all are, but you can move forward and you can be okay. You just need to start being pickier about the people you surround yourself with. So once you know who you are again, and you have figured out just even basic things like what you like to eat and what your favorite color is and what music you like to listen to, because sometimes we forget when we're living so much for that other person and trying to please them. Once you know these things, then somebody's going to come along, whether it's a friend, a romantic interest, a family member, and going to be like, hey, I like that song too. I like that color too. I like that food too. Let's go out and have sushi on Friday night together. And you will start to, you'll just start to feel better. You'll start to feel like a human being again. And you'll start to see that there's other good people in this world, and that the people that are for you, you're going to be enough for. You're not going to be enough for everybody. You're going to be too much for some people, but your people, you'll be just right for.
Well, you don't need a lot of people. Let's be real.
And you don't need a lot of people.
We grow up and we think, oh, look at that person. They're popular. Look at all the people that are in their lives. But most of those people are a facade. They're phony. They're fake. They have their own stuff going on, and they're attracted to that person because that person's so much full of energy, or they seem very, attractive in nature. And at the end of the day, you only need a couple good people in your life. I've narrowed my life down and got rid of so many different friends that are energy vampires that had their own abusive tendencies, which were reflected at me, or where I'd only hear from them when they were going through something. Besides that, they were never there for me when I needed something, whether it was good, bad, or indifferent. They were never there. They weren't a constant in my life. So start looking at your friends, your associations, not just friends, though, the associations of who you hang out with. What are you watching? What are you listening to? What are you reading? What are you putting
in your mind?
Exactly. And if you got that icky feeling, you need to divert and change your associations. Even people, like I've gotten rid of people, so many people in my life, that I've got it down to only a few, like literally 2-3 close friends. Family, you mentioned earlier, you don't have to associate with people half hour, I go family events for certain things, half hour before, half hour after. I'm not saying I don't love those people. You can love somebody and not like them, right? Mm-hmm. People don't get that, but it's possible.
Yeah.
You can love who they, you know, you can love them because of a specific reason, but you can focus on healing yourself, changing that association, and just have specific people that make you feel good. For me, it's a 70-30 principle. 70% of the time when I think of Dana and I get glad and I can't wait to see Dana again, Dana and I are together and Dana walks out of the room and I'm going, geez, I can't wait to see Dana again.
Right.
30% of the time Dana posts, or maybe not even direct conversation, posts something and I don't agree with it, but it's not morally apprehensive. It's not reprehensible. It's just, we're not agreeing on everything. Big deal. But 70% of the time, you better make me feel glad, because if it hits 50-50, bye, Dana. Enjoy your life. I'm never going to talk to you again.
You're right, If you can take or leave somebody, yeah, I agree with that 100%. And I'm the girl, let me just say that since I've spoken out about abuse, I have had my stepfather's family basically exile me. None of them have anything to do with me. Most of my mother's family, nothing to do with me. My ex-husband's family, who I was closest to for 25 years, completely cut contact with me. My husband now, his family, they're not interested. I mean, like, I don't get invited to baby showers and stuff.
What a blessing.
You know what? That's what I've come to. I used to cry about it, that I had nothing and I'm alone and all this. And I'm not making fun, because it was awful. I mean, my husband would sometimes find me in fetal position sobbing because I felt alone and orphaned in this world. But that is the thing. You have to realize, why would I want to? I'm not a people pleaser anymore. I'm not going to go grovel for somebody to want me somewhere or to like me. You know what? That's fine. It's unfortunate that sometimes your family, whether, you know, biological or otherwise, if they don't want anything to do with you and you don't want anything to do with them, it is what it is. But yes, you are better off, because my family are, like you said, I have like three people who are my core people, and they got my back. And if they're the only ones at my funeral when I die, then so be it. At least somebody will be sad. But you know what? It's better off. There is nothing wrong with being who you are and being loved by people, even if just a few, and loving them back. You have no obligation to love your family or to forgive
unapologetically you. That's what you need to be.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Unapologetically you, and love who you are. You know, you talked about getting into the fetal position. I used to lie in my bed in quiet desperation, trying to raise my kids, going through court stuff to get permanent custody of them. And then I got it. And then there's financial. Then there's, oh, you need to find a good woman to raise your kids. Yeah, how are you going to do it on your own? Everything, all the noise that I'd hear, and I'd cry, and I'd have to hide and bottle that all up. And then I became unapologetically me. It took years of personal development to a point where I liked what I seen. And that person that didn't like what I'd say, I'll say to people, depending on who it is, I'll look at them and, you know, I hear what you're saying, but that sounds like a you issue. That's not a me issue. I do. You'd be shocked. People will go, what do you mean? Well, you just finished telling me all this stuff and it trying to insinuate that I had some part of it or making it me.
Right.
When really it's a you issue. And you know what, if they're not willing to communicate about it or to make some butt hurt and they walk away, like my dad would say, don't let the door catch you on the butt on the way out. Goodbye. Right?
Exactly. Not everybody. I think people need to realize that not all of us are meant to get along. We're not all going to sit in a circle and sing Kumbaya together.
You know, I was thinking the exact same thing.
Some circles I don't want to be in. Exactly. But you have to be okay with that. And I think once you get to that point, you are okay. You're going to be just fine.
Oh, absolutely. So Dana, as we talked about, you're the author of a best-selling book, Gasping for Air, The Stranglehold of Narcissistic Abuse. I found myself, when I wrote my own book, it was very cathartic and healing. Yes. And one of the best things I did to move on in my life and pass the trauma from childhood all the way up to now. And I'm not labeling any of my family or people that caused it. It was just things that happened. I look back at it and what did it I learn from it? And this is what I put in my book. So it was really great for me. What was your experience like for you? And could you share a story from your book that could be a catalyst for someone to seek help sooner than later?
Oh, goodness. Yes, it was absolutely cathartic. I think for me, because I am a writer, getting everything from my memory onto a computer screen or onto paper, because sometimes I'd be out and I'd need to make notes. It was like I was able to look at it a little more objectively or see patterns of behavior that my memory couldn't sort out itself. So in that way, it was really helpful for me to better understand my role in everything. Even I figured things out. I was with this man 25 years, and there were things I even realized about him that explained things. It didn't make it right or justify it, but it certainly helped me kind of come to terms with, okay, he was ill-equipped, you know, to really be in a marriage at all, and, you know, whatever else. But it definitely gave me that objectivity. So by the time, you know, it was 3 years it took me to write it, because there were times I had to take a break, sometimes for a few months. I couldn't live in the past. I wanted to
mentally
live in the present,
emotionally exhausting.
Yeah. And I would have psychosomatic symptoms. But by the end, when it was published, I remembered I was reading it for, you know, the actual, you know, physical copy of it for the first time. And I started laughing, and I'm remarried. My husband says, "What are you laughing about? Your book isn't funny at all." And I'm laughing now, but I was like, I don't know this. I wasn't even laughing at anything that was funny. It was awful. It was a traumatic thing that happened in my former marriage, but you know, I thought this is good. This is good. If I can look at it with humor now, and whether it was a nervous laugh or what, it was better than crying. It was a sign that I was healing. And I know even from writing, you know, getting done writing the prequel, and I'm working on the prequel was really tough. Some of that childhood stuff that I thought I had overcome, boy, you figure out real quick when you get triggered where you're not healed quite yet. So, you know, there was some stuff there too. So I always recommend, if anybody is interested in journaling, it does actually help to see your words, because even as a matter of fact, this morning I pulled out the original journal that Gasping for Air was written from, and I was reading it, and it's just interesting how even with time, you look at it differently than you did back then, or you feel differently than when you were writing it. So you can see things from a different perspective than you can when, you know, when you're fresh out of it, or even after you've just written it. So it's helpful. It's definitely helpful. As far as a story, what kind of a story would you like? I have a lot of them.
whatever you think would help people be able to understand what it is you wrote for them to connect to, want to feel comfortable enough to reach out to yourself or anybody for support.
So this is just maybe a page and a half, so forgive me, but this is actually pretty much towards the end of the book, but I have to give myself a pat on the back. I've had a hard time complimenting myself, but I did write this beautifully. So this was the day that we had, just to give some perspective, we had a small farm that had the main house. There was a guest house that was built like for an in-law arrangement. And then there was a big barn and a cow paddock and a chicken coop and all this stuff. So when my ex moved out, typical narcissist move, he was playing this game. He moved out of the main house and up into the guest house, the in-law house. But I had a terrible time getting him off the property, even after the divorce and even after the title and the deed of the house were put in my sole name. So this was when he finally moved off the property. And I had agreed to stay away for the day because he was moving. He had moving trucks and mutual friends there that I didn't want to make them feel weird. but my son had been there all day and I was very anxious to get back to my son. So this is when I returned. When the coast was clear that night, I was anxious to get home. Doug accompanied me. He knew how concerned I was for Ryder and wanted to be at the house to support us both. As we drove up the gravel drive, I scanned the grounds like I was looking for something. The second story window in the second house, which usually glowed from Darren's constant TV watching, was vacant and dark. The trucks and trailer, which usually crowded the side drive between the big barn and the chicken coop, were gone. The place almost looked abandoned. It was eerie. When I got out of the car, I looked around for what I still sensed was missing. Then I realized what it was. My triggers, my anxiety, my fears, the tension and worry that I'd done something wrong or something bad was going to happen. It wasn't that Darren was gone, but rather the effects of him. I had apparently grown attached to the trauma he'd put upon me, and now I felt empty. I wonder if Ryder felt the same. Eager to get to my son, I rushed through the door with Doug right behind me. We immediately froze when we saw the empty eating area, the kitchen table, which Darren had crafted for me from tree trunks and carefully chosen maplewood planks, was gone. Never mind he was legally prohibited from entering the house. He'd done so to prove the rules didn't apply to him, and additionally to affect Ryder. Only a selfish bastard could leave a boy and his mother without a table to eat meals upon together. Ryder appeared out of the dead quiet hallway. He saw me and Doug standing there with the door wide open, staring at the empty space. Like a well-trained soldier, he retreated to his bedroom and returned with the black folding table he'd borrowed from me a while back. He carried it to the center of the eating area and slowly folded the four stick legs outward. Then he flipped it over to stand upon its flimsy legs and centered it under the light fixture. I remained still as I watched Ryder place our four white farmhouse-style wood chairs around it. I wasn't sure if he was trying to pacify his own anger, prevent me from unnecessary upset over family dinners that would never be, or if it was a strong show of how Darren couldn't affect us. Whatever the reason, Ryder's determination to withstand Darren's offense made me proud. In all these years with Darren, I'd demonstrated to Ryder how to rise above the BS and make the best of what we were left with. And now, in this very emotional moment, my son was showing me how to do the same. I stood more resolutely than matching Ryder's strength to move forward. Doug placed his hand on my back as if to guide me to sit at the table Ryder had just made for us. I looked up at him with a grateful smile and took my first brave steps forward into our new life. I went to the cupboard above the refrigerator, removed a plastic tablecloth I'd used for parties, and spread it over the thinly cushioned top of the card table. Ryder helped me even it all out, and we all sat down. Although no words were shared between us, I knew Ryder and I were thinking the same thing. Darren could deprive us of his love. He could strip us of our sense of who we were and what we could be. He could take away the table where we tried to sit as a family and remove himself from our family altogether. But he couldn't destroy our family like he'd tried so hard to do. Ryder and I were still here. We had each other, and now Doug, and a folding table, standing on flimsy legs, but still standing. We were resilient.
Wow. Very powerful. It's, you know, I can see walking into that room and the table not being there. I can visualize it. But at the end of the day, he really did you a favor. He did you a favor to have that healing moment with your son to move forward. Yeah. And really, at the end of the day, I wouldn't want to sit at a table that that man made.
It was just a beautiful table, but yes.
beauty doesn't take away from the trauma, though. It doesn't take away from that.
No, and you're absolutely right. But that's right? The thing about it. And I think that's what I tried, and what I tried to instill in my son is just that things are things. And it's how I went through the divorce. I remember telling the attorney was saying, but you're entitled to this and you're entitled to that. I said, I can make more money. I can go buy new things. I don't care what he wants. Give it to him. I just want my son and I want to be free. And that's what I got.
That's what I did too. I gave everything that I had. I took all the debt on. I took everything on.
Yes,
I didn't ask for anything financially from her. I paid for everything all the way from when they were younger till they got older, and moved out on their own and they're adults. But at the end of the day, nobody was going to have that kind of control over me. I didn't want to be that parent wondering if they were going to pay me, whether or not they were going to pay for their half of the extracurricular activities, whether or not they were going to show up at stuff. Guess what? I showed up. I taught my kids that they could always, I was dependable. They could count on me and just continue to move forward and heal. Right. And that's all we can do.
Exactly what I did. Exactly. Just, I said that I'm going to be the stable and consistent parent. What he does is up to him, but I'm going to be the one. And, you know, to this day, when my son needs something, he comes to me. And it's unfortunate for my ex. My son relies on my new husband now. This man has been more of a father to him than, you know, my son's actual father. And it's sad, but that's how life is. I'm just glad that, you know, I could provide what I could to him, because I know it wasn't provided to me by my own parents.
Yeah, good for you. So, Dana, if you had to give our listeners one last closing message, what would you tell them in regards to giving a heck and never giving up?
I would say this: listen to your gut. You don't have to excuse it. You don't need to justify it. You don't have to have any reason for feeling whatever you're feeling about a person or a situation or anything. Trust your gut. It is usually telling you something. My great grandma used to say it's your guardian angel whispering in your ear, but whatever you think it is, listen to it. Because if I had listened to mine, boy, well, we wouldn't have had a book, but we're not going to go there. So just listen to it. I think it would help us all out tremendously if we just really, you know, trusted ourselves enough to know that, you know, that feeling is there for a reason.
That's a great closing message. I appreciate that. So, you know, this has been a great conversation. I've so appreciated your insight and knowledge. And hopefully those that have been listening or watching this episode have gained a lot from it. I know I certainly have. You know, the more I learn and the more I can relate to other people's pain, trauma, and how they've utilized things to help them through it and get past it, it continues to help me grow and evolve. And so I really want to say I appreciate you. Thanks so much for coming on. You're welcome. What's the best way that people can reach out to you?
I would advise everyone to go to my website, danasdiaz.com. You can click on links for Facebook and Instagram from there. You can email me directly from there. Link for the book is on there, but I think everybody uses Amazon anymore. So the book is available there. And just a quick note on that the book is available in ebook format. I wanted to be sensitive to anybody that might want to read it, but couldn't have a book that has the word abuse in the title sitting on the coffee table. So just know the ebook is there and it's free if you're a member of Kindle on Amazon. But also this podcast, this will be on my website, on my press room page. I ask everybody to share it with somebody that you know that might be in a situation, because usually if you approach them about it, they'll deny it, excuse it, you know, not even acknowledge it at all. They don't want the shame or the conflict with you. But maybe if they hear about it from us, it might resonate differently. So please share it if you think somebody could benefit from this information.
I completely agree. Those listening or watching, listen to what Dana says. You know, it is so powerful when we share, because somebody could be in that vulnerable situation. You're not realizing exactly how to help them. Sometimes the biggest gift you can give them is to say, here, listen to this. Here, yes, maybe pick up this book. Maybe, you know, again, I like the fact that I give my book out all the time as an ebook if people want it. Like, no problems. Yeah. Like, people can, they can get my book for free by paying the shipping. They can go to Amazon, but there is, I don't know, there's a couple hundred people now that have got I have a marketing campaign that's going on that people, all they have to do is click on it, put in their name and their email address, and the system will automatically send in my ebook that, and my publisher set it up for me. Cause at the end of the day, there's not a lot of money in writing books. There's no money in it, really. It's more of a passion thing
for helping people.
Yeah, to want to change people's lives. So I don't care. I just Once in a while, I get a commission check from Amazon for like $6 or $13 yes. because somebody actually buys it instead of gets it for free. And that's fine.
I know.
Thank you. Appreciate you buying it.
Exactly.
leave a review. That would be really good.
Yes, exactly. But I agree with you. I carry a box of them in the back of my car. And every once in a while, you find that person that you're like, you know what? Here.
I just got another you need 25 to read this. Right over my shoulder, right over over top of my computer here. I got another box of 25 that come in a couple days ago. Even when I travel, I'll take four or five with me. People say, what do you do? And we'll have a conversation. I'll say, are you a reader? No, not really. Okay. Yes, I am a reader. Great. If I give you a book, are you going to read it? Because nothing worse than a book collecting dust on. I was in Europe last year for 3 weeks. I met up with a friend of mine. I took like 8 or 10 books with me. By the time I left, I'd given them all away.
Oh, cool. They're
not, even if one person reads it, great. If not, right?
Yeah.
I'm not looking to self-fulfill and have vanity about it. Having conversations with people on the trip. And I was going, my book could help you.
Exactly.
Everybody I talked to never got a book. Only they certain say people that I thought would help.
1 out of 4 men and 1 out of 3 women supposedly are in a toxic relationship. So they're out there. If you're in a group of 4 or 5 people, 1 or 2 of you can benefit from something that we have shared in this conversation. So it's worth sharing.
For those new to the show, you can go to giveaheck.com, go into the podcast part of the website. You'll see a picture of Dana, and below that you'll see abbreviated show notes with how to reach out to her website, her social media contacts, and check her out. This has been an amazing conversation. Any last words before I wrap up the show?
I'm just so grateful that you had me on. I appreciate it, and I just encourage everybody to, you know, look deep down inside, ask yourself what you want, and if what you want isn't aligning with where you are, decide to make a change.
Exactly. I appreciate that. So thanks so much for being on Give a Heck, Dana. I appreciate your time and sharing some of your experiences so that others too can learn. It is never too late to give a heck. Thank you for taking time out of your day and listening to Give a Heck. If you find value, I'd appreciate you sharing with your friends and family so they too can learn how to live life on purpose, not by accident. So you do not miss the next episode, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, and please also post a review. I look forward to reading your comments. This has been Dwight Heck. If you want to check out other podcast episodes or today's show notes, please check out my website, giveaheck.com. And until next time, together, let us all strive to give a heck.